This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
How do imperial legacies shape present-day academia and knowledge production? How are the colonial past and obligations arising from it debated today? What role do they play in political relations within Europe and in Europe's relations with the rest of the world? These are some of the questions we seek to address in our new 8-lecture series in cooperation with the Fritz Thyssen Foundation on science, knowledge, and the legacy of empire. This podcast episode is a recording of the second lecture in the series given by Sebastian Konrad, Professor of Modern History at the Free University of Berlin, under the title Colonial Times, Global Times, History and Imperial Worldmaking. Sebastian Konrad's lecture explores how the construction of a particular Western notion of time and temporality, of modernity, was central to the constitution of Western imperial hierarchies in Asia in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Drawing on examples such as the alignment of calendars, the synchronization of clocks, and the writing of history, Konrad argues that, as producers of historical time narratives, in the process of imperial world-making, historians became imperial agents and world-makers in their own right. But was this purely a colonial imposition, or a response to global conditions? What are the lasting effects of this reshaping of temporality, and how does it influence us today?
Thanks so much for the invitation, for the kind introduction. Thanks to Christina, also to Indra, to the Thyssen Foundation, to everyone else in the room who helped make this happen. I'm honored. I'm glad to be here. Thanks so much. I'll start with a person probably most of you don't know and have never heard of, a guy called Ludwig Ries, who was in 1887 recruited by the Japanese government to transform, or in fact create, the Faculty of History at the University of Tokyo. Now, Ries was a young student in Berlin. Nobody really knew him, but he had two things going for him that made him attractive for the Japanese government. The first thing was that he was considered a student of Leopold von Ranke's. Ranke, considered frequently as the father, quote unquote, of modern history, conveyed him with a prestige and a reputation that seemed to make Ries as well one of the pioneers of modern history. In fact, however, Ries never attended even a single seminar of Ranke's. He didn't even sit in on any of his lectures, but he had a reputation of a neat handwriting. And Ranke, who was already close to his 90s, needed someone to turn his almost illegible handwriting into manuscripts that somebody else could actually read. So that was Ries's advantage, turned him into, if you will, a student of Ranke's. The second thing that is that he knew English. He had written his dissertation on British history, English history, and at the time, the professors recruited to Tokyo University, they had to deliver their seminars and lectures in English, part and parcel of a, if you will, imperial building of a new institution where all the incoming professors, but also, yeah, most of the themes, most of the topics were essentially European or English. I mean, Ries, he stayed in Japan for 15 years or so. He married a Japanese wife. He had 5 children with her, but still at the end of his term, he hardly spoke any Japanese and had to stick to English throughout. Now, he came to Japan as a reformer. I would call him an agent of empire. He radically transformed the institutional landscape of history at the time. He created a new faculty of history. He organized a new journal, the Shigaku Zashi, which was closely modeled on the Historische Zeitschrift, the German journal for modern history. Also, the methods that he introduced were essentially German. He taught methods according to Droysen, and even the themes, the topics that he taught, were essentially European. He taught English history, European constitutional history. European history was history in many ways. Now, he was about 26 when he came to Japan, which made him much younger than someone like Robert Clive. It's rather unusual to put Clive and Ries on one single slide, and I do admit that it's a bit of a provocation. Clive is famous or infamous, and nobody knows Ries, right? Clive is an imperialist, while Ries is essentially a scholar. Clive conquered a continent, if not an empire. Ries gave a couple of lectures. But in some important ways, I would hold, empires were not conquered and held by soldiers, militaries, generals only. In fact, they were the product of a much broader form of cultural hegemony that required people like Ries and others to bestow upon societies outside of Europe, if you will, a cultural template that made them believe or in some ways acknowledge the, how should we say, the cosmology on which empire rested. Tapan Ray Chowdhury, the historian who taught at Cambridge, once said about South Asia that there is the, as he called it, well-known fact that initially there was great enthusiasm for British rule in India and the colonial projection that the British conquest was the best thing that had ever happened to India was widely accepted until the 1890s. That is even beyond the 1857 revolt. Now, if that is the case, then that's clearly not due to the presence of a few British soldiers or of British merchants alone, but it is due to the fact that what Gramsci called hegemony was what the British peasants essentially expressed, namely the idea that the kind of society that Britain promised with its promissory notes, as you could call it, was what India should aspire to. And at the core of this understanding is a sense of temporality. What is the relationship between the past and the future? In other words, the historians, the lords of time, they were the levers of empire. They were the agents that bestowed this sense of connecting the past to the present and the future. And in that sense, I would claim Ries, unbeknownst to himself, was an agent of empire too. Here's a quick roadmap of what I'll be talking about today. I'll talk about history as an imperial discipline for a couple of minutes and then use three examples going back to the Japanese case of how historians did this work in practice. And then finally come to a discussion about whose times were actually used, talked about, appropriated, and so forth. Let's start with the first one, history as an imperial discipline. You know, there's a huge literature on many disciplines, including economics, anthropology, geography, and so forth, that are usually seen as complicit in empire building. Historians are usually, they are typically not the subject of these kinds of studies. But if we speak about history as a discipline, we need to, I think, embed it briefly in the larger context of the notion of time and as it changed in the course of the 19th century. So it's not only about history and the narrative about the development of societies, but it's also about the way in which clocks, calendars, and so forth produced a new sense of time within which the new discipline of history was also embedded. So in the 19th century, clocks and calendars dramatically transformed the landscape also in Japan, which will be our test case tonight. The clock became the symbol of modernity, but more than the symbol, it was really the point of reference adorning schools and factories. The best graduate from Tokyo University was given by the emperor himself a pocket watch as a sign of recognition. So in some ways, the clock not only represented modernity, but was modernity. Alongside the clock, also calendars were introduced. This is from a schoolbook that shows how the inculcation of this new mode of time, it's not only about, you know, knowing the time, but it's about being punctual, not wasting time, right? That's, in other words, the clock itself is an agent of developmentalism, if you want to say so. Apart from the clock, there's also the calendar, right? The calendar, essentially the Gregorian calendar, is adopted around the world at this time, in many cases because it was imposed on colonial societies. But even in places that were not colonized, like in China, in Korea, in Japan, in Russia, Ottoman Empire, the Gregorian calendar was gradually adopted. And this is a Japanese rendering of the merits of the, or the meaning of the Gregorian calendar. Essentially, it says, look, this is June, it has 30 days, the 1st of June falls on a Monday, and then it explains what this precise day was in the old calendar, right? Which maybe was a day where you shouldn't deliver a letter because it was inauspicious, or it was a day where, in other words, all kinds of meanings and significance was linked to that day. In the new world of 1st of June, it was simply a Monday. So clocks, calendars, and then also time as developmental time or qualitatively changing time, that is history, was part and parcel of this new regime of temporality, as we could call it. So when in the 1870s, a German doctor by the name of Erwin von Belz taught, he also taught at the University of Tokyo, he taught medicine. He talked to a local interrogator who told him, we have no history. Our history begins now. Belz was a little surprised. I mean, Japan obviously had a long history to look back to. It also had a long tradition of historiography, of history writing. But what this person meant was that, you know, all these traditional annals and records of history, they essentially remained on the surface and didn't capture the qualitative change that only the modern discipline of history can. So in that sense, history really only begins now. So this combination of clocks, calendars, and historical narratives produced a sense of temporality that was, to many contemporaries, new. Now, a couple of words about why I chose Japan as the object of study. Now, there's clearly a biographical aspect to it because I studied Japan myself, but also because I believe that Japan is a very good example for this, for the simple reason that Japan was both a colonizer and a colonized. We all know that the Japanese Empire was one of the largest empires in the world, at least from 1905 onwards, 1910 until 1945. But at the same time, Japan had developed a sense of being colonized, at least culturally colonized. Not only that, in the 19th century, Japan was subjected to what was called unequal treaties, and it took the Japanese government and diplomacy several decades to undo these unequal treaties. But then into the 20th century, the sense that Japan culturally was on the receiving end of colonialism was very strong. And scholars like this colleague, Komori Yoichi, they claimed that Japan throughout operated with what he calls a colonial unconscious. So in many complex ways, Japan was both colonizer and colonized. And also, if we think about the notion of time, that's very obvious. For example, Japanese bureaucrats, when talking about their own colonies, could say something like, you know, we need to develop a 100-year plan to develop Taiwan because they're so backward, right? Or Mitobe Inazo, who is a professor of colonial studies at the University of Tokyo, says, you know, we need 800 years for the civilization, quote unquote, of certain colonized people. At the same time, Japan had the sense of being a backward nation, a latecomer, right? The terminology of coming late is visible throughout. So this double sense of both imposing a new sense of time and being a victim to it is very typical for the Japanese case. All right. I'm already in the second part of the talk, and I want to briefly lead us through three examples of how this notion of time arrives and what it means. The first one is quite straightforward. It's essentially this. It's a woodblock print from the 1870s in Japan. And what you see here is an allegory of different temporalities. So on the right-hand side, we see a person who looks like a samurai with traditional garb, the traditional top knot, and represents the feudal Japanese society. In the middle, we have someone who's sort of an in-between figure. He has a hat, an umbrella, he wears shoes, in distinction from the samurai kind of figure. But he still also wears traditional garb. And on the left-hand side, we have the new modern Meiji-era gentleman with a top hat, a walking stick. He even has a dog on a leash. you didn't know that that was a sign of modernity, probably. Now, interestingly, so this looks like an innocent sort of street encounter, right? It's an encounter that could have only have taken place in Tokyo, in the Ginza district, where you had these brick buildings, which themselves were a sign of modernity. Now, it's not quite that innocent. So what we have here is a pocket watch, right? So probably the person on the left asked this guy what time it is, and he pulls out his watch, again, a symbol of the 1870s, right, of modernity, if you will. And the picture sort of conveys what could happen if Japan is not on time, right, if it is too late. He pulls out his watch, but it's entirely clear that, you know, modernity could easily revert to backwardness again if Japan isn't attentive. So the whole notion of both being in time and punctual and to operate according to civilizational time is very neatly captured in this image. We'll already move to example number two, which takes a few minutes longer. And it takes us into the very early 20th century. And it's about the notion of periodization. Now we are, when I say we, I essentially mean myself. I was taught in, you know, in the university, but it was taken for granted that history essentially developed according to a set of periods, right? There's antiquity, there's the Middle Ages, there's early modernity, and then there's modernity. Essentially, antiquity, the medieval period, and modernity, this is the tripartite template for all history anywhere. Now, not so in Japan. As is typical for all East Asian countries, in most East Asian countries, the periodization is according to dynasties, right? So you have the Song and the Tang, the Song, you have the Ming, the Qing would be the Chinese setting. Now, the Japanese problem is they had only one dynasty. The idea is that the Japanese emperor and his dynasty ruled from 660 BCE uninterruptedly into the present. It's probably a legend, but essentially the idea is there is just one dynasty. So what do you do to periodize? Now, the Japanese solution is this. They say we differentiate between the seat of government, and this yields the Heian, which is Kyoto, the Heian period, Kamakura period, Muromachi period, Edo period. And then within these, we differentiate by emperors, right? So there's different emperor, and with every emperor, the counting begins anew. Unless something untoward happens. So for example, if there's a natural disaster or something, then the emperor decides, no, we'll change reign name and start again, right? So for example, the Komei emperor, you can see that he faced different and difficult times. He had to restart all over again several times. I think that the German reigning coalition would like to do the same as well sometimes. So anyway, this is a system which is very specific, right? It's very particular. You can't say, you know, in the Genji period, the U.S. president did this. It doesn't seem to work. So it seems like a parochial and very specific, and also in some ways very confusing and complex setup, which led the Japanese education ministry in 1889 to ask the historians to clean this up, right? 1889 is the moment when Japan gets a constitution, and the government essentially asked the historians to create, if you will, a constitution for history as well. That is a periodization that is compatible and that is in some ways on a par with the periodization that you have in civilized countries. Now, the Japanese historians were initially skeptical. And in fact, they said, we can't do it, right? It's impossible because Japanese history is simply so different. So when in 1893, at the occasion of the Columbian exhibition in Chicago, the Japanese government decided to produce a handbook, Japanese historians had this to say. They say, in the West, it is customary to divide the period of a nation's history into ancient, medieval, and modern. Yeah. This method had begun of late to come into vogue in Japan also. It is doubtless a suitable method in the case of other countries, but in Japan, the salient incidents of history do not lend themselves to the adoption of such a system of division. In other words, sure, for the West, yeah, but in Japan, it's not compatible. And in fact, historians in Japan, they toyed around with the idea of several of periods. They came up with the idea of seven periods, of five. There's one historian who claims Japan had 14 periods. The penultimate went all the way up to 1150, and then the last period was the, you know, the rest. So it seemed a difficult endeavor. And then only in the beginning of the 20th century, the picture changed. And now ancient, medieval, modern was also adopted in Japan. And the book that did it is this book by a historian called Harakatsuro. It's called The History of the Japanese Middle Ages. Now, in this book, if we look into this book, we see exactly how the logic operates. So he says, if we look at the Franks, for example, right, then they can serve as a model to understand the Japanese bushi, that is the Japanese warrior class. We could also say the Japanese samurai, right? In order to understand the samurai, we need to understand the Franks. If we want to understand what happens in Japanese Buddhism in the 13th century, we should look at Luther's Reformation that gives us a model, a template to understand it. If we look at Tacitus and the German villages, they help us imagine what the east of Japan, where the traditional warrior culture emerged, as he calls it, must have looked like, right? So we see that what he essentially does is he fits Japanese history into a much larger template that's already set, and then he links Japanese events or Japanese occurrences to this larger structure. There's a colleague of him, Nakada Kaoru, also in the very same year, in 1906, has the following to say. He says, "It never ceases to amaze me how closely medieval Japan's legal system and legal principles resemble those of the Franks. For that reason, knowledge of Germanic law was necessary to study Japanese legal history." So ultimately, the framework is given, and then the Japanese past is rearranged accordingly. It's no accident, actually, that this happens at this moment in time, because it's just a year or two after the Japanese victory over Russia in the Russo-Japanese War, right? It's the moment when Japan represents itself as modern, as fully modern, a modern country that can look back to a period that looks medieval, right? So the idea that Japanese modernity is in some ways predicated on a sequence of time where you have something like a golden age, and then the medieval period, which is usually seen as a period of decline, and then modernity. This was very much part and parcel of the self-understanding of the Japanese elite at this moment. The medieval period could be a time of internal strife, and now you have national unity. It could be seen as a period of the reign of the shogun, and now we're back to the reign of the emperor, as in the old days. It could be seen as the period where, you know, the medieval period as the period where Chinese influence was imposing itself on Japan. And now, only 10 years ago, Japan defeated China on the battlefields. Now, Japan does without China. So you could easily read a dark and, you know, a period of decline as medieval as the Middle Ages into Japanese history and celebrate Japan's modernity. But what was mainly happening is what I wrote on this slide. This is the moment when we see a transformation from dynastic to national histories, because the traditional way of writing history in Japan, as in many other countries, was one where the history of the dynasty was essentially the core of writing the past. Even in the so-called Great Japanese History, which was completed in exactly that year, 1906, this is still a history of the different emperors and their courts. So what the transition from dynastic history to the ancient, medieval, modern template actually achieves is a transformation of the subject of history, right? The driving force of history, which is now no longer the emperor, but it is the nation. At a moment when Japan industrializes and modernizes, also the subjects of this process, namely the Japanese nation, quote unquote, becomes the subject of history, which requires a different kind of chronology and periodization. One more and last example, and now that takes us into the post-war period after 1945, after the Second World War and after defeat, and it's the period of the American occupation of Japan, when one of the most famous historians of his time, Utsuka Hisao, had the following to say. He was a Weberian, right? He studied Max Weber, and his work and used Weber's categories to understand the past. He was a specialist himself of British and Dutch history, so of European history, but he was very clear that he studied the European past primarily because it helped him understand Japan, right? The study of European history, he says, serves as a background against which Japanese peculiarities can actually be examined. And the example I want to give is his treatment of the post-war reform. So the American, under American occupation, a dramatic set of transformations took place. Among them, land reform, the dispossession of large landowners and the redistribution of land, right? So it's a radical social reform. And Otsuka himself, he celebrates the reform, right? He says, this is, you know, this is fantastic. These are reforms, he says, which we didn't think possible in our wildest dreams. Now they, you know, they become reality. But what do they actually mean? How can we understand the historical significance of these events, right? Land is taken away from some people and given to others. What does that actually mean? Now, here's what he says. He says, the historical significance of these reforms was surprisingly difficult for us Japanese to understand, but they become entirely obvious the moment we compare them to West European, above all English and American history. So once we look to Britain, then it's entirely clear, right? What look, we look at Japan and everything looks like chaos. And we look at Britain and then we suddenly see that it's all arranged and it all makes sense. So is it that the Americans should simply impose these reforms? No, he says, no. I mean, they may look like the ones who do this, but in fact, this land reform had been necessitated, as he says, by the historical and structural contradictions of Japanese society. It cannot be explained by any kind of pressure from the outside. The Americans are simply the handmaidens of a process that's, you know, that's decided already. So this is another and my last example of how historians turn the periodization that they receive into a mode in which they interpret Japanese history in a very particular way. Now, is this a colonial imposition? We'll come back to the question from the beginning, right? And this is how historians, in particular in the tradition of postcolonial scholarship, have typically seen this. So very briefly, let's run through two, three texts that have dealt with history and the history writing from a postcolonial perspective. There's Johannes Fabian's text, Time and the Other, where he shows that anthropologists have looked at the colonial societies that they study and have assumed that they were operating in a different time zone. They were not part and parcel of the same present, right? It's what Fabian, with a somewhat inelegant term, calls the denial of coevalness. He says, to create this difference between us in the present and the society we study, who are allegedly in the past, creates the conditions that make colonialism actually possible. Then there's a different set of studies that looks at what the new temporalities actually do to colonized societies. One of the best known examples here would be Thomas Troutman's book on the clash of chronologies, essentially arguing that we have chronologies and forms of regimes of temporality in India, and then the European chronology, and they clash, as he calls it, right? It's an early version of the clash of civilizations, which means that the arrival of Western chronologies replaces, or at least marginalizes, if not completely annihilates, local forms of making sense of time, right? Then we have this Prasenjit Dwara's work that focuses on the way in which temporalities are streamlined into national histories as a result of Western historiography. Western history writing turns all kinds of histories, all kinds of pasts into national, by necessity, into national narratives. And also this does away with the plurality of cosmologies in the non-Western world. And then maybe the most radical version of this kind of postcolonial critique, maybe postcolonial isn't even the right term, would be Vinay Lal's book on the history of history, where his aim is not to criticize history as a discipline, but to completely do away with it altogether. And he says that India, so in other words, different from some of the other postcolonial scholars, it's not about transforming history writing, but it's about, well, killing the project from the get-go. So he says India made a choice, a civilizational choice, as he calls it, of doing without history And it has lived comfortably with that choice until very recently. And one more quote from the book where he says, "History has every potential to be a form of cultural genocide, politically disempowering and destructive of the ecological plurality of knowledges and lifestyles." Don't tell this to your undergrads. Right, so this is a radical critique, which in some ways also links to the other critiques, essentially saying that alternative forms of making sense of the past and the future are eradicated by the imposition of history as a discipline. Now, what have been responses to this? How can we do better, right? And are there ways of moving out of and beyond these kinds of chronologies that have the kind of power that we just witnessed in the three examples that we looked at? So here, I think the most lively and in some ways most productive debates are around scholarship that is usually linked to decolonial approaches. So scholars from that kind of background have tried to revisit and resuscitate epistemologies that were on the verge of disappearing. The author of this book is currently criticized for all kinds of other things, but he's a typical exponent of this kind of approach, as is Walter Mignolo. The phrasing is very typical, right? Learning to unlearn, or epistemicide. These are the terms that are used to argue that forms of cultural production were essentially marginalized, if not annihilated, as a result of the hegemony of history as a discipline. Now, these kinds of approaches, I think, are very they're very interesting, they're very generative, they're very productive in many ways. They provide, let's put it this way, points of views from which one can criticize and critically engage with history as it's being taught in universities essentially around the world these days. At the same time, they also have a couple of problems. One of them being that this kind of approach essentially sees the problem in the way in which discourse operates, right? So the discipline of history is problematic because it conveys the wrong logic, or because it is, how should we call it, a failure of thought. It remains on the level of narratives, as if we change the narratives, we would change the structures that we're actually critiquing. So that's one problem. The second problem is that it tends to be, I hope it's not, you know, too polemical if I say nostalgic about pre-colonial societies. This is even true for someone like Dipesh Chakrabarty, who in his famous book has this famous passage where he talks about the way in which there are challenges to Western temporality in the Hindu-Bengali context that he in some ways wants to revisit, right? He says, "There is a collective memory that challenged the seemingly absolute separation of sacred and secular time on which the very modern European idea of history was based." So he says, in the colonial context, there were alternative notions of looking at time. And then he quotes from 1876 contemporary commentators who talk about the role of women specifically, and say women are the Lakshmis of the community. If they undertake to improve themselves in the sphere of dharma and knowledge, there will be an automatic improvement in the quality of social life. So the Lakshmis of the community essentially means that they're responsible for the well-being of the community. So if they live a life of modesty and devotion, of chastity and so forth, then this will benefit the community. Now, Chakrabarty is the first to point out that this is, in some ways, a very patriarchal way of assigning a role to women, but nevertheless goes on to say that it marks the denial of historical time by making the family a site where the sacred and the secular blended in a perpetual reenactment of a principle that was heavenly and divine. So I don't know, we would have to ask him whether he would, you know, still celebrate this today similarly, but it seems clear that, you know, if we go beyond Chakrabarty, but more in more general terms, there is sometimes a longing for a form of pre-colonial society that has its own hierarchies built into them. So just simply going back before the age of colonialism doesn't necessarily provide us with cosmologies that are more emancipatory or have more potential as a tool for liberation. And the third problem with these approaches is that they're frequently hijacked by racist, xenophobic, right-wing people. This is the day, we're just one day after the Turkish elections, but the former, to give you just, you know, a couple of examples, Erdogan's former foreign minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, emphasizes the Islamic paradigm as absolutely alternative to the Western. So the emphasis on alternative cosmologies is not only a tool against the West, but it's frequently also a tool to create the kinds of societies that, how should we say, that implement their own forms of repression and imposition. There are several such examples. There's the International Islamic University in Malaysia that, and the history department operates with the premise that history as taught here needs to move away from the scheme of ancient, medieval, modern. The history should be taught in contradistinction to the notion of world history as it's taught in some countries in the West. Probably the most powerful, if you will, case would be China, where a whole discipline called national studies is being institutionalized in the most famous universities. For example, at Tsinghua University in Beijing, for example, would be one such case where you have, right, you have your faculty for your department for sociology, for political science, and geography, history. But then you have next to it the Department for National Studies, which essentially tries to use Chinese ways of knowing from before the Opium Wars to, you know, to rethink the past. And of course, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it could be actually a quite powerful tool to rethink the landscapes of knowledge. But what it yields is frequently something like this. This is the director of the World History Institute of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, who says about world history Chinese style the following. He says, "Our research on global history manifests our standard of value judgment, our view of history, our values, our Chinese people's feeling, and our Chinese people's understanding of the historical reality. Patriotism remains the soul of China's world history studies." So we can easily see how the emphasis on alternative ways of knowing can merge with and fuse with new forms of parochialism and new forms of centrism that replace Eurocentrism with just another centrism. Now, where does this lead us? Whose time is it? Anyway, I will close with reflections on the purchase of the postcolonial paradigm and how it relates to global history approaches that in some ways are complementing each other, but in some ways also depart from each other or part company, as it were. So let's briefly revisit what I started out with. At the beginning, we said that the new form of temporality operates both on the level of clock time and calendar time and on the level of history and historical narrative, right? So how Western, non-Western is this in the first place? Now, if we listen to someone like Oswald Spengler, right, the cultural critic philosopher who wrote this just in the aftermath of World War I, right? She says, the kind of time that we operate with is inherently Western, right? Day and night, from thousands of towers, the strokes of the bells can be heard across the land. It's impossible to imagine Occidental man without the most precise measuring of time. So temporal precision is at the heart of European culture, is what he says, right? So what happens if this temporal precision travels? When it first traveled, the most precise clocks traveled to Japan in the 17th century. This is what the Japanese did with them. They imported these clocks, high-tech products of the early modern period in Europe. They imported them because they were a conspicuous symbol of wealth and power. They were incredibly expensive, so only the feudal lords were able to afford them. Now, the problem was that these precise instruments, they told the time in a very regular manner. That is, whether day or night, whether rain or shine, summer or wind, an hour was always an hour. Now, in the Japanese context, that was not the case. As in most pre-industrial societies, the hours in the day were longer during the summer than in the winter because they were calculated from sunrise to sunset. They varied with the seasons. They varied between day and night. So what to do with a precision instrument like this? It doesn't help much. So what you do is you add additional springs and weights that make it possible to undo, if you will, right, the precision of this instrument. You have to exchange the clock faces also to make sure that from season to season it works differently. So with technical ingenuity, the Japanese undid the technological progress that these clocks represented and achieved, if you will, an imprecise time, right? So this looks like a confirmation of what Spengler says. Precision time is Western time, and the rest of the world, they live in a different kind of temporality. Until we travel to a place, an inconspicuous place across the Atlantic called New Haven. There's not much to see, but in the 1820s, the town hall needed a new clock, and they hired the most efficient, proficient clockmaker of the time, Eli Terry, who built a clock that was as precise as these instruments we just saw, right? So whatever the season, whatever the weather, time was even and regular. How did these North Americans, Occidental man, quote-unquote, react? They hated it. They said, this is not the time that we operate with. Our time is different. In the summer, the hours are longer. In the winter, they're shorter. What is this, right? The Connecticut Journal in 1825 says, with sarcasm, well, you know, to have a clock in a town to tell the public what the time is not is certainly a novel scheme. Thank you. A public clock which tells the truth four times only in a year is something very much like public nuisance. So what do we have here? What about this dichotomy of precision and European and Western societies? And then the rest, at least New Haven wasn't part of the West according to this standard, right? So it seems that in many ways, precision time was a novelty around the world, not only in Japan. Well, what about history, though? The narratives of history in the sense of qualitatively changing time. So there's a German author from which I quote, he, and one of the characters in this novel says, it's most disagreeable that one cannot nowadays learn a thing once and for all and have done with it. Our forefathers could keep to what they were taught when they were young, but we have every 5 years to make revolutions with them if we do not wish to drop altogether out of fashion. My mother could have said the same thing. So essentially what he's describing here is a situation where this radical qualitative change comes as a challenge, to say the least, right? As a threat even, right? He describes what another fellow whose work is being celebrated and whose life is being criticized these days said in different words, but essentially the same kind of thing, right? So we could say that the kind of history that is transferred to Japan in the 1890s was also a challenge in Europe in the, let's say, in the early 19th century. It came as a, not as an invasion from the West or from the outside, but as something that was as revolutionary, as challenging, and as, in some ways, intimidating as well. Which brings me to the political theorist Lubna el-Amine, who says, well, is it not in many ways this constant concern with sorting out what is Western and what is not that replicates an imperialist discourse? Is it right? Does it make sense to assign these geographical indices? Does that explain how this temporal change actually operated? Or should we not look at a set of broader structural transformations that helped this process emerge? So instead of looking at changing cosmologies only, let's look at the ways in which they colluded with, interacted with ways of transforming society very substantially, very fundamentally. So, I mean, this would be another talk, but just as a sort of a, you know, preview of it, we would have to look at the ways in which a set of fundamental transformations prepared the ground for these new forms of temporality to actually resonate and make sense, which would lead us to a study of the capitalist transformation of the economy that gradually in the 19th century engulfs the world, right? Which is clearly the driver of much of temporal change in the 19th century. This is an image of a clock where you have to clock in. Do you also do this at the Institute? You do. All right. Yeah. So this feels like home then, right? So clearly the capitalist transformation and also industrialization, the transformation of the workplace is clearly one of the main drivers of this process, as is second, the formation of nation states that, like in this case in Beirut, they erect these clock towers, they remind the population, they synchronize the population and make it understand that time, the way it is imposed, is social time that matters. Here's an example from Japan, where they, in the 1920s, create a time exhibition, right, to make sure that everyone knows that the beautiful customs of valorizing time and punctuality, they need to be inculcated and they need to be, you know, the population needs to learn how to be on time and obviously to work hard. It's actually ironic. So when I first traveled to Japan in the 1890s, that's what my children think. That's how old I am. So in the 1990s, the Japanese government, you know, what they did is they said, look, this is a post-industrial society. We need to move away from the 6-day week, working week. We need to create a weekend where people rest. So how to do this? People have to learn what to do on a Saturday. You can, for example, ride a bike or you can go to a park. So they created these schemes that made the population learn how not to work. Now, in the 1920s, it was still the opposite. So the capitalist transformation of the workplace, but also the agency of the state and of the ruling elites that imposed this new sense of temporality. And third, yes, of course, empire also, right? Empire clearly was one of the main drivers of this change. This is the so-called noon clock in Cape Town that went off at noon every day, very symbolically both synchronizing the colony, but also, you know, showing and demonstrating the very close link between time and power. So obviously the empires also imposed a new sense of time, but they didn't do this primarily by dictating ways of writing about the past, but rather through transforming the societies that they ruled in a way in which this new sense of temporality actually began to make sense. And lastly, I would also hint at the power of the paradigm of the natural, of the example of the natural sciences that in the 19th century becomes so hegemonic and seemingly universal, right? The language of the natural sciences that seems to be based on a form of objectivity that is culture inspecific. That's not a nice way to say it, but it's irrespective of culture, valid everywhere, which then led to all kinds of cultural production to be legitimized via the language of the natural sciences. Just one example here at the end, Buddhism, right? The Buddhists in both Sri Lanka, but also in Japan, like this fellow here, claimed that Buddhism was the most modern religion. Why? Well, Buddha's teachings are in exact agreement with the doctrines of modern science. God is a God of evolution, and evolution means progress, right? Because reincarnation is a form of evolution. And all the, you know, these miracles that Christianity is about, forget it. That's the old days. Now, Buddhism is modern. Now, is this simply an invention of tradition, as Hobsbawm would have called it? Sure it is. But what is the idea that this new temporality is actually European? Or the outcome, as it's frequently used still in the literature, you always find it is the outcome of Judeo-Christian time. Now, all these Judeo-Christians in the 19th century, they were surprised, right? They didn't feel that this was the outcome of traditions. They felt that this was a challenge and a threat. So the invention of Judeo-Christian time in that sense, I think, is just as much a symbol of this transformation process that happens here in Asia as well. So to conclude, I started out by saying that, yes, also historians are agents of empire, and I, to some extent, stick to that. I do find, however, that by going down the sort of post-colonial and decolonial reading alone, we may end up in a situation where it's all about changing the terms, changing epistemology, and changing the discourse. And I think that is, in some ways, a dead end. And we need to marry these approaches with the, let's say, global history concern of transformations that operate on a different and more structural level. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.